Well, so we're happy to have the continuation of Igor's talk about fractional brains and gravity duels.
Thank you. So many of you were here for the first part and some were not, so I just want to remind what I'm hoping to cover. And so what I talked about last time was just brief review of ADS-CFT, then cone brains, basically the setup where you put brains at the tip of some general cone. And then I discussed the specific example of the conifold as a cone that preserves n equal 1 supersymmetry after you add brains, and how to get it at the dual field theory. Then I talked about adding mRep d5 brains around the 2-cycle of the base of the conifold, t11, to get this non-conformal theory and discuss the picture of the RG flow in such a theory, ending with this mention of the RG cascade. So what I'll do today is talk about the infrared dynamics of this RG cascade and the necessity of deforming the conifold. Then I will talk about the kind of phenomenology of the resulting theory, and show that it gives a kind of nice new picture of a gravity dual, which has neither any kind of naked singularity, nor does it have a horizon, unlike the ADS case. It just has a space ending gracefully, basically. So this solves the problem of graceful exit from the cascade and also automatically buys you the area law for Wilson loops and the existence of other objects that you expect in the field theory. So then I'll talk a bit about the dimensional transmutation exhibited by the two-point function. And I will also talk quite a bit about the new work with Chris Herzog about more general fractional brain gravity duals. And also we'll mention the work of Cvetic and collaborators on the resolution of a D2 brain geometry, which works in a pretty similar way to how the warp deformed conifold works, but just in another dimension. I think it provides another interesting example of this phenomenon. Okay, so just a review, let me just flash by you this solution. So the solution for n regular D3 brains and m wrapped D5 brains on this the tip of the conifold, it has exactly the same type of ansatz as the regular D3 brain, with the difference being that the warp factor h now picks up an extra logarithmic term proportional to g string m squared. And the dilaton is exactly constant for this solution, just like it was for the regular three brain. So the presence of this logarithm means that that the flux, in some sense, because the five form flux measures the effective number of three brains, that becomes dependent on the radius, and one has to explain this. So it's actually a picture of an RG flow where the number of colors itself flows logarithmically. Okay, and the suggestion that Strassler and I made is that this is due to the so-called duality cascade, where if one tracks the couplings of these two gauge groups, the bigger gauge group pretty quickly hits an infinite coupling, and then it needs to be dualized, which precisely accounts for changing n to n minus m, as suggested by the gravitational picture. Yes.
So in the n equals 2 case, it's just there's a different picture that it's Higgsing its excessive state. Isn't there? I guess, well, Hilbert is suggesting this, for example.
Yes, but this is quite a different situation, because there you had that was a case when the brains were not space-filling. They were not filling the singularity. So the Higgsing took place along this 5 plus 1, along the
information from one to the other.
Not obviously.
Okay.
I mean, here, what happens is that the brains are not localized within this fixed plane, because the conifold is six-dimensional, right? And you're just left with 3+1 dimensions, and the brains are filling it, so you cannot...
Right.
The Higgsing that took place there was basically spreading them along these the remaining two dimensions.
Yeah.
So here, I don't know, it might be possible to invent some more complicated Higgsing interpretation. Perhaps Ofer will tell you more about it. We had many discussions on this. But it's not the same, it's a totally different story, really, because here the only Higgsing, the mesonic Higgsing that you could have is, say, adding expectation values for operators like trace AIBJ, but that would break SU2 cross SU2 symmetry, while our background actually preserves the symmetry. So if there is any kind of Higgsing interpretation, it has to be baryonic Higgsing, where you give expectations to baryon number. And that's a very complex story, which, well, this story at weak coupling is fairly straightforward, and I think even Offer believes it now. So, but indeed it would be interesting to...
And I've asked this question before, you've answered it before, I'm sorry, but the cyber duality per se is a statement that you have two different theories
of the ultraviolet,
they float at the same fixed point, right?
Yeah, here you kind of have to apply duality along the flow.
Well, all I know is what Madame Igor explained to me, and which makes sense. I don't know if I can explain it better than them. The question is, what do you mean by calling it an SUM theory, I guess? In the middle, I mean, I think that when they're saying it's an SUM theory, they don't necessarily mean that it's really the same thing that you would flow to from a free asymptotic free SUM theory or something like that, because these theories are anyway not really asymptotically free. So you have to define very carefully what you mean by saying that. But
you're
I think they convinced me that there was a reasonable way to define that.
Yeah, I mean, we're
scale and
right. We have to.
You have to define it sort of by flowing against there as you flow in some very specific way or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're starting to flow there. So it's not, and you're never going to end up at some asymptotically free fixed point that wouldn't enable you to really call it an SUM theory or anything like that. So you have to be very careful about exactly what you mean. But in some sense.
But I thought there's every duality, they agree at the fixed point.
Right, but not beyond that.
So right. Now you're trying to flow up in
exactly,
the same way, but call it two different things.
I mean, you can flow up in one theory, and then you can give that flow up an interpretation of the other theory and things like that. But it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be what you would get if you had started from the asymptotically free fixed point in the other theory.
It certainly it's a slight generalization of the original duality, but
actually, I had not appreciated this point. I'm happy now to understand it, but I'm now really quite confused by precisely what you mean by cyber duality, because as we were discussing last time, we're really not anywhere near the origin of the gauge coupling space in these theories. These are all non-trivial fixed points.
But we're in some sense flowing very slowly, right? It's what happens is that when M is zero, right, then you just have a conformal fixed point. So you're thinking of M as the parameter that breaks the conformal invariance. So you're sort of in the vicinity of a conformal field theory that way. And
yeah, but it's a strongly coupled conformal field theory. It's not the...
Sure.
I mean, it's not one of the theories that Seiberg encounters in standard Seiberg duality, right? Which are...
No, why not?
You can turn down the coupling and get something which is a gravity dual at the same cascade.
Yes. See, at strong coupling, the cascade proceeds very fast, right? As I explained, the steps between the cascades are of order G string M, 1 over G string M. But then, if you imagine dialing G string M to be small, then you have well-spaced steps between the cascade, and that's what...
But I thought it never made any sense to think that G string M is small. G string M is of order 1 near the fixed point.
No.
Well,
no,
that's a tunable parameter.
No, here it's a tunable parameter.
It's a tunable parameter.
Yeah, the thing is, let's see, when one of the gauge groups gets, so So look in the vicinity of this. So one of the gauge couplings is huge, okay? And the other one is very weak, right? And then if you ignore the interactions of this other gauge group, then it's literally the application of cyber duality to this SUN plus M gauge group. So then it's, I mean, if you are confused by this, then it's good to recall this T-dual and S-brain picture, because all that happens here is that you have these, so you have a circle, right, and you have, and say, an NS-brain and an NS-prime brain. Okay, and the conformal...
Can you just, look, the thing that's bothering me is we were talking previously about being in a regime where this superpotential that you wrote down had dimension 3 rather than dimension 4.
Right, right.
That is, can't be in a regime where any coupling constant is weak. So I just don't understand what statement is being made about weak coupling.
That's not true. It's enough for one of the couplings to be strong to allow that. I mean, the other, I mean, for instance, you could take one of the gauge couplings to be arbitrarily weakly coupled as long as the other is very strongly coupled.
Okay.
Yeah. That's enough for...
Fine. For, and then now, yeah, what are we applying cyber duality to?
Well, that's... That I don't know. I don't have a good answer to. But you can be sort of very close to the fixed points. So
the claim is the strong.
These are the strong coupled fixed points that are like those of NF equals 2 and C in cyber duality.
So they are in
some limits you are very close to those fixed points with some small deformation that
they are the same fixed points that you're accessing.
In some limits, which are opposite from the limits where supergravity is valid, but in some limits then you are very close to
So in the strongly coupled sector of this theory you're close to a fixed point if you treat the other thing as just a global symmetry.
Yes.
But now you quote unquote cyber dualize. If you just cyber dualize the fixed point, what you get is the same thing. You get the infrared limit of it.
Right, the
same thing. What you're saying is that although you were very close to the fixed point here, you now cyber dualize to,
well, that's why the,
to the other massive theory, which is now very far from the fixed point, or from a fixed point.
No, it's the same fixed point, just continue flowing from it in a different
Well, if you're at the fixed point, you're not going to continue flowing.
Well, you're never exactly at the fixed point here. You never exactly reach the fixed
point. You're never far from the fixed point. I mean, if M over N is small, you're really flowing very slowly.
Okay. So you're always getting closer to the fixed point, even when the flow turns over.
You never get to the fixed point, right?
Right.
You get to the confining theory in the infrared.
Right.
But you're applying this approximate duality in the vicinity of this flow. Okay. I mean, in the vicinity of this point.
But this has got to break down before you get to before the million jumps.
That's right. I mean, we'll see precisely how it works on the gravity dual. But all that happens in this NS brain picture is that you have, so when you have equal numbers of D4 brains stretched this way and this way, okay, then there is exact balance and nothing bends, right? And that's the description of SUN cross SUN theory. This is actually how we realize that it's Seiberg duality. The moment you add, say, an extra brain here, this is the fractional brain. This will create bending, okay? And when the brains interchange places, this is basically the picture of cyber duality that was advocated by Litsur, Kutasov. So all what happens is that these brains start kind of deforming as a function of the scale, and every time they cross, then this jump occurs. So the crossing of the brains is this point here. Okay, so from this point of view, it's literally the picture of duality, you know, the NS5 brain picture of duality that was elucidated by those people. So this is, you know, it's very clear when M over N is very small, and then eventually you get dynamically through these jumps, you get to the regime where M is of order N, and then there is a pretty big revision to the story, which I want to discuss. So now, what this solution that I wrote down does not get is this end of the story, right? Because what happens is that, in some sense, the cascade happens systematically, and then you eventually hit the place where N, in principle, can go negative, right? Because there is this logarithm, and nothing prevents it from going negative. And this is really the source of the problem here. And correspondingly, the H, this warp factor, can hit zero at some point. And this is a naked singularity. So the question is, so what we'll see is that there is some general phenomenon that is at work here, is that this naked singularity signals that there is some non-trivial infrared dynamics which favors a less symmetric state than what we have imposed here. We really put in an ansatz which is too symmetric because this T11 just shrinks rigidly. Okay, there is no internal deformation of T11. And what theory really wants to do is to produce an internal deformation of T11. So the presence of this singularity is this solution telling us that chiral symmetry breaking really occurs. Okay. On the other hand, when you go to the UV, then the cascade goes without bound, and there is absolutely no problem with curvatures there. In fact, they get very, very small because of this extra logarithm. So how do we think about that? This seems to produce a totally new kind of UV behavior where n is dynamically basically diverging. So maybe this could serve as a definition of truly n equal infinity theory. And the question that one might ask is whether this is a local theory or not, or what kind of a beast it is. And I will try to at least start answering this question by computing the two-point function in a theory with this type of UV behavior, and try to argue that at least there is no a priori divergence in such a two-point function. In fact, it exhibits dimensional transmutation in a sense. Yes?
Just a question. The T11 has an SU2 times SU2 times E1 symmetry.
Right.
And I guess this metric would preserve that, but other background fields must break some of that to a smaller symmetry already.
No.
So the solution is actually SU2 squared times E1 symmetry.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the full background, including the gauge fields, the way these forms work out is that they're completely U1 symmetric and SU2.
All the things that's printed out. And SU2 symmetric.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So how do we get a clue about what sort of chiral symmetry breaking pattern do we get in this theory? And it was very helpful for us to think about what actually happens on the gauge theory side. Okay? So there are two different pieces of intuition. One is what happens on the gauge theory side, and then there is very simple geometrical intuition that after you wrap the D5 brains over this two-sphere, it basically wants one of the S2s to shrink faster than the other. Okay? So you know, it's a sort of trivial statement, but in fact this is what happens. And we were confused with Arkady why we did not see it in our solution. What turns out to happen is that we just didn't put an ansatz that allowed for that, and that's why we really ran into a singularity. So let's look at what happens in the gauge theory. Okay, and let's consider the case where you've cascaded down to just a single regular brain left, and M wrapped D5 brains, okay? So then you will naively get SUM plus 1 cross SU1, and of course there is no such thing as SU1, so you really get SUM plus 1 gauge theory coupled to two flavors, right? So you have these fields A and B now become C1 and C2, which is in the fundamental, and D1 and D2, which is in the anti-fundamental. And this story has been well studied in the 80s, for example, by Affleck, Dine, and Cyberg, the other ADS. And we basically used the formula for the induced superpotential from their paper, combining it with the formula for the quartic superpotential that we introduced to get an interesting phenomenon. And the phenomenon is basically, so if you ignore this dynamically induced term, then you will just get the old conifold equation, the undeformed conifold equation, which just says that the determinant of NAJ will be equal to zero. Okay? Because when there is no term here, you'll just get this nicely. Now, if you factor in this term, then the variation of W vanishing gives you the equation that this determinant to the mth power you're just given in terms of some ratio of scales. And there are m different solutions which are related by the unbroken Z to M R symmetry of this theory. So you basically find that the Z to M is broken down to Z2. So once this constant term appears, this equation can just be written as determinant of Nij is equal to some constant on each branch. And the m different solutions of this equation are related by these Z to M rotations. So you get this deformed conifold equation just from this extra term. Okay? So in this particular theory, we see that that basically the moduli space for this remaining regular brain will get deformed from the conifold to the deformed conifold, basically through this effect.
Can you say where the first term came from?
Well, the first term, that's what what I talked about last time, because you find that this theory, this SCN cross SCN theory, must have a quartic superpotential, okay? And this quartic superpotential, so in the SCN cross SCN case, it had the form W is trace AIBJ AKBL times epsilon IK epsilon JL. Okay? And one thing that I didn't explain in detail but is true is that under these duality transformations, this superpotential essentially keeps its form. Okay, that when you carry out this Seiberg duality transformation, you will get back to a quartic superpotential. So when you cascade all the way down, you're still, and this is this quartic superpotential at the bottom of the cascade, right? So it's quartic in these fields C and D. Okay, so this is the deformation of the conifold in the field theory language, and we see that, so in the large M limit, the Z to M is, as usual, essentially indistinguishable from the U1, okay, and it's broken to Z2. That's what we'll see very cleanly in the gravity solution, that this U1 symmetry that you started with, which is just the U1 R symmetry of the T11, will get removed. Okay, so just a reminder about the deformation of the conifold. Okay, so the picture, this is the transparency from last time. We saw that in this case, the S2 gracefully shrinks to zero, okay, smoothly, so locally you have an R3 here, but the S3 remains of the finite size. And the other reason why you might want to keep S3 a finite size is that there is a conserved M units of D5 brain flux that's actually piercing this S3, and that's what wants to support this 3-cycle. So from geometric point of view, the reason for this problem, the naked singularity, was really the simultaneous shrinking of this cycle together with this cycle. And the deformation basically removes this problem. The space comes to an end before the cycle shrinks. Okay, and then we also see why the U1 symmetry is broken to Z2, because the U1 symmetry just acts as Zi goes to e to the, well, all the Zs go to e to the I theta times Z, right? And when epsilon is zero, then any phase rotation is allowed. This is the R symmetry. But when epsilon is there, you can only change the sign of Z. But epsilon prevents you from doing arbitrary rotations. It's very clear, right?
Well, what happens to the gravity solution when n is small but n is large?
Strictly speaking, we don't want to, we want to consider the Hopf limit for m as well. So but we want to keep G string m large. Otherwise the solution develops a small curvature, because really what is going to happen at the end is that the size of the sphere is of order G string M.
And the large curvature.
Large curvature.
Also, in your solution, there is no separate M parameter. There is only one integer.
Excuse me?
Your solution is parameterized by only one integer. There is no M. There is only M.
N is flowing, and M is the conservative.
Unlike the solution with Seidman, in which there was separate M parameters.
Mm-hmm.
So not for small n, you might expect to see a Zn.
No, 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 no. The solution with Zeitlin also had only one parameter, basically. Because after you rescale the radius, you only saw G string M squared.
After you rescale, yes.
Yeah.
The other parameter was constant.
Yeah, there was a scale. Yeah. I mean, if you write the solution this way. Yeah, if you write the solution. Let's see, where is the. Yeah, you can write the warp factor precisely in this way. So there is G string M squared and some scale R star. This scale R star is going to make a dimensional transmutation into just the physical scale. There is always some indeterminate physical scale of all the variants. So that's why I would say that there is also just G string M, and that's what blows up the warp factor. Okay, so let me move on. So this I already told you that you have, so this way of writing determinant Zij is equal to minus epsilon squared, the same as writing the original sum of Za squared equal epsilon squared equation. And so all of this motivates us basically to replace the singular Ricci flat space, which is the carnifold, by this non-singular Ricci flat space, which is a deformed carnifold, and basically look for a solution with this warp deformed carnifold rather than the warped carnifold. And this involves still involves quite a bit of work, which namely has to do with finding the right configuration of these three-form gauge fields. And that's what I want to briefly discuss, because essentially, the really simple form of the three-form gauge fields that was there for this solution with Zeitlin is no longer applicable. And one wants to introduce, so the way you guess what are the good basis of one forms is you basically want to look up or construct the formula for the metric of this deformed carnifold, okay? And this can be, so the carnifold metric can be written in various ways in a diagonal form. But the deformed carnifold metric really prefers this G basis over the E basis. Okay? So E5 is basically the one form corresponding to the psi direction, to the U1 direction. And the remaining four things labeled the 2-2 spheres. Okay, and after you form these linear combinations, you find that the deformed carnifold metric is completely diagonal in this G basis. And it's clear geometrically what happens, that basically the G1, G2 span the shrinking 2 cycle. Okay? So when you go to tau equals 0, that's really the apex of this deformed carnifold. Here, these two directions smoothly shrink to 0, and locally you get d tau squared plus tau squared times something. So this will be your R3. And the remaining three directions, which is G3, G4, and G5, they just produce a round metric of S3. Okay? And so everything is working in this metric quite nicely. And that suggests that you should construct the ansatz in terms of these G forms. And moreover, you know exactly what the Ramon-Ramon field strength should look like at the tip of the carnifold, at the apex, right? Because there, it should just point in the directions of this three cycle, because that was the whole point. We've blown up this three cycle, and that's the directions in which F3 should sit. But then you immediately realize that something quite complicated must happen, because asymptotically, we want our solution to reduce to the previous solution, okay? And there, it's set not just in these 5-3-4 directions, but basically set symmetrically in 5-3-4 and 5-1-2 directions. So that's why there has to be some rotation of this 3-form from tau equals 0 to tau equals to infinity. And this rotation is parameterized by a whole new function that you have to put in. Okay? And similarly, you want to put in an ansatz for the B2, which also kind of rotates between what happens at r equals 0 and what happens at r equals infinity, where these two functions become again symmetric.
So the f3 is a closed form, right?
Yes, yes. So here, yeah, so df3 has to be equal to 0. And this is indeed true for the sunset. That's why we put a d of something over here.
D of something would not change.
Yeah, yeah.
D squared of 0 something.
That's why I added d of something here. Right? I couldn't just... So this by itself is a closed form because it's a volume form of this S3, right? This part. This is just the volume form of this S3. And it has to, then at infinity, it's basically G5 wedge G3, G4 minus G1, G2, okay? And it has to interpolate between these two by just being D of something else, right? Okay, so luckily within the sansatz you can construct the self-dual solution. And then the 10-dimensional metric ansatz is the simplest thing you could imagine. Namely, you stick this Ricci flat metric here, and it has this natural radial coordinate tau, and you make the, again, single warp factor solution with the warp factor just depending on tau and not on the angles. That's really why the thing will have so much symmetry. It preserves the full SU2 cross SU2 and just breaks this U1 that was obvious already from this part of the metric. Okay, so I will skip the technical part, but basically what you look for in these BPS systems is that you will not be solving the full second order Einstein equations. They have to come from first order equations. Okay, and this turns out to be the case quite simply. So there is a dramatic simplification of the equations you need to solve. And actually, three of these equations just concern the sansatz for the Ramon-Ramon and the Schwartz three forms. And all that they do is they imply the self-duality of these forms. Basically, all that it says is that the six-dimensional star of F3 is proportional to H3 and vice versa. Okay? So these equations know nothing about the warping. They're just nicely reduced to a mathematical problem of finding a certain type of forms on this particular non-compact color beyond manifold. Okay?
What was F3
and what was H3? F3 is the Ramon-Ramon field strength, and H3 is an SNS. Well, some people denote it as RR and an SNS, but I just kept the label of the size of the form. And then, so the crucial thing is just finding these harmonic forms. Once you found them, then the warp factor just reduces to an integral, okay? It's not a second order differential equation, just an integral. And so what we were lucky with is to be able to guess the right ansatz to get a solution of this equation. And then it turns out that these three equations are nicely solved in terms of these elementary functions. Okay, so this is the explicit form, and it satisfies all the properties that we wanted this to have. Namely, at small tau, for example, F will vanish as some power of tau. Okay, and at large tau, it tends to 1, which reproduces. So this F of tau kind of accomplishes this rotation of the three forms, and similarly, the F and K will become equal to each other at very large tau. And they're rather different at small tau. So,
what is alpha?
Excuse me.
What is alpha? There is a letter
alpha. Alpha is just a parameter, which is basically g string m squared.
How to find it? What is it equal to?
There is just some number of order one here, which, if you're careful about constants, it's. Yeah, it's just a normalization. Yeah, precisely how you quantize the three forms will fix it. But the important thing is that it's just the Toft coupling squared, okay, times, I don't know, 27 or something like that. Okay, so this is basically the complete solution. And then, so the main point of this was to look for a solution where H is non-singular. Okay, And you see that because this is positive, H is going to be monotonic. So that's exactly what we want, right? So because this object here cannot become, so the problem really was coming from this negative, unphysical negative number of three brains. As soon as this number is maintained positive definite, H is going to be monotonic. And what H really does is that at small tau, it's something like this, and then at large tau, it just approaches zero. Okay, and the whole thing is of order, and it's multiplied by g string m squared. Okay, and this is why you don't get a naked singularity anymore, because a naked singularity came from this turning around and hitting a zero. Okay, so that's the crucial point. And you can solve for h of tau in terms of this integral. You find that as tau goes to zero, h is indeed some number of order unity times g string m squared. But as tau goes to infinity, it nicely matches onto the previous solution, and therefore exhibits this cascade. Okay, so in terms of the old R coordinate, it has exactly this form. So therefore, for small tau, we approximately get R3, 1 times the deformed conifold. And so to emphasize, there is no horizon either. There is neither a singularity nor a horizon. Horizon really is telling us that the theory is conformal, right? That's sort of one of the things we learned. Once you get a solution without a horizon, then it's a confining theory. So horizon meant that H would blow up, right? If H blows up, then...
But it's only a very special kind of horizon,
which
means it's conformal, right?
Right. Well, it's just
well,
yes,
special. I tell you that there is no mask up. It doesn't tell you.
Yeah, yeah. But I think H would need to blow up in a certain way, right, to get the conformal field theory. Okay, but if it just stabilizes, then that generically gives the area law of the Wilson loops. So then you notice a few nice things about this finite S3. One is that a D3 brain wrapped over S3 will now be stable, and this will serve as the baryon vertex connecting M strings. Okay, so from the string creation mechanism, you see that there must be, so when you wrap a D3 brain over this S3, it's not going to have finite energy, right? It's going to have these strings coming out to infinity, and these strings will have to connect to external quarks. Okay, so this theory will have baryons, therefore. And then the D5 brain wrapped over the S3 will be a domain wall separating two adjacent vacua. In total, there are m vacua, and so there have to be these domain walls. And as I said, when g string m is very large, the curvatures are small. So here the phenomenon is very similar to what happened in the basic ADS CFT, that except the dependence actually is slightly different, because in that case, this warp factor was multiplied by g string n, and here it's for some reason multiplied by g string n squared. Okay, but still, when it gets large, you get. So it seems like we get a faithful description of this cascading confining theory in this limit. Okay, and the QQ bar potential is linear, basically because when you study this Wilson surface, it's going to prefer to go, because H is monotonic, it will prefer to go basically to the end of space, to tau equals zero, and just stabilize there. So when you move the quark and an anti-quark far apart, you're going to have this linear potential. And you can, in fact, you can just try to calculate the spectrum of glue ball masses. Because the space is smooth, it's clear what to do. You can just look at the spectrum of normalizable modes, say of the dilaton or of some other supergravity fields. And you indeed find that the spectrum is discrete. And this was studied in already in these papers.
And the string tension is what, g squared proportional to
Okay, there is again a mismatch between the you know, the scale of global masses computed from supergravity and the string tension. I think the string tension is, I think it's by factor of G string M off.
This has always got to be true whenever it's the supergravity approximation.
Right, right. Yeah, I think this is a generic thing because.
But what power are you getting through each of them?
What's at your scale except for one of these things? Right? There's always some scale, so what do you mean by?
Yeah, but he's asking what's the relative power in terms of the global mass. I believe that T is G string M times global mass squared. It has an extra power of G string M. Okay, but the nice thing is that you can actually see, so you can do more. You can actually look at some two-point function of some operators and study it as a function of distance. So because the spectrum is discrete, you know that when you separate them by a lot, it's going to decay exponentially with the mass of the lightest global. But perhaps a more interesting question is what happens at short distances. Okay, and for that, so this was studied by my student Michael Krasnitz, and it amounts to just doing a rather straightforward matching calculation in the metric. So what happens is that when you move these, when you go to very high momenta, intuitively, you will only feel the UV region of the metric. So it turns out that the crucial part indeed comes from the simple story where you know the metric perfectly explicitly, which is this logarithmic tail of the metric. Okay, and here you basically want to approximately solve this equation. It differs from the usual solution just by this extra log. Then when you introduce the natural dimensionless variable, instead of a constant, instead of one here, you still get a log. And you can ask, does it completely screw up the calculation?
Does that mean log y over y? Where is the
big, no, it's big y over little y.
Big y.
So big y is AKR star, okay, and little y is this thing. No, I think you want this log to be actually big, right? So.
You could have called one of them Y star.
Okay, sorry.
One has a tail and the other one doesn't?
It's just R over R star.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it starts, this here it's obvious, right? Yeah, I think you're right. This has to be Y star. Okay, so the question is, can we have a solution which at Y equals zero just approaches a constant? Okay, because before, for this minimally coupled scalar, we could just have these solutions where phi of zero was set to one. And
Y equals zero is
infinity. Y equals zero is really R equal infinity. That's why we did this inversion. And we want to develop small y expansions first. These are the UV expansions. And in fact, this log is really a small effect because there are already two derivatives here. So a large effect which would really shift the behavior would be something that goes like 1 over y squared. But because it's small, it's approximately constant. So you find that for sufficiently small y, namely far in the UV, the expansion of the solution has the following form. It still starts with 1, and the log only affects this y squared term of order y squared. Then you want to match this to another solution, which is valid for big Y, and you find so the physics is contained in this constant C. This is actually what determines this flux factor, the boundary term. And this constant C turns out to be a log cubed of AK R star. Usually it's just a log. Okay, in the ADS calculation, this would be a log. And this would give you, after Fourier transforming, so in momentum space, you would get K to the 4 log K, which after Fourier transforming would give you 1 over X to the 8. But here you have actually two extra powers of the log, which means that when x is much less than the scale AR star, Okay, and A is G string M. So this is really the dynamically generated mass of the glue balls. This is like lambda QCD here, because the logs fill the ratio of X to this thing here. Okay, so what's the interpretation of these extra two powers of the log? The story is basically you want to think of them as the result of this flow of N. Okay, because N itself depends on the scale logarithmically. Okay, our interpretation is that this is just N effective squared, which is present in all planar calculations. Okay, so the N squared that's always there now became X dependent and multiplies this 1 over X to the 8. So the pleasant thing is that...
you could interpret this as an anomalous dimension.
I don't think we have a completely conclusive story because we haven't yet computed a three-point function.
Something that protects the anomalous dimension.
Yes, I think the anomalous dimension will turn out to be zero, actually.
It's not clear to
for certain operators.
Of course.
But there might also be anomalous dimensions, but this effect I think should be there.
This is simply. the leading behavior.
Sorry?
Small x, of course.
Yeah, I mean, because this thing is already there and I think we interpreted it correctly, then this 1 over x to the 8 is telling you that this particular operator has no anomalous dimension.
No, it's not
asymptotic
retreat theory.
No, it's not. No, what happens is that the couplings flow in this kind of... Yeah, so the overall, you know, 1 over g1 squared plus 1 over g2 squared does not flow. And the dilaton is really the modulus that measures this thing. But because it's a modulus, it's an untwisted operator, I don't think it will have an anomalous dimension. But the log is still there, and we think that the log is really a result of this flow of the effective number of colors. So the worst possible...
Am I supposed to interpret this in some kind of field theory context? Flow of some kind of theory with the number of colors depends on
the position? Well, that's the question in a sense. I think the gravity dual in some sense defines the theory for you, right? And the question is...
Well, normally duality is a relation between two theories.
Not the definition.
What?
Ideally, that's true.
So how do you view this as a field theory?
Well, you compute correlation functions and try to tell whether it makes sense.
What does it mean that N flows as a function of X in the field theory?
Well, another...
Sort of a new kind of field theory.
Yeah, I mean, it's a... But the worst possible disaster that we were afraid of is that if you just because strictly speaking, at arcical infinity, things are infinite, right? There is an infinite N, and the question is, so when you compute this two-point function, is it just going to be infinite or not? And I think the answer is it's not infinite. There is just extra logarithmic dependence on delta x. Okay.
In two dimensions, there's this roaming trajectory story, right? Mm-hmm. There's this theory that flows down through all mm-hmm. of the minimal model mm-hmm. points. Is there anything in that story that looks like this as you go up that cascade? Because they also have some cascade. Okay.
I don't know.
Which accumulate up.
They accumulate.
Yeah, you say
but
the
good, one. Yeah, right. Yeah, which is not C equal infinity. Here it really goes to infinite central charge. Yeah.
If
yes.
You look at black holes or black brains in this background, what is their underfield?
Well, that's what we're trying to work out right now. I think the answer is that indeed the same effective N will of course show up at the... I mean, here's the way I think about it, that the bigger momentum, so it's a very strange theory that the more, say, the more you heat it up, the more number of colors are in it, okay? So strictly speaking, at small At low energies, it doesn't feel an infinite time. At low energies, it's just an SEM theory. Then, as you happen to go to higher and higher energies, you bring in more and more colors.
Right, yeah. So there will be extra logarithmic terms in the area? Is that
yeah,
true? That's what you're guessing? That as you make the...
Because the entropy yes. will be growing.
But isn't it just as that we have some strongly coupled gauge theory, at any energy scale, we can try to describe the strongly coupled gauge theory in terms of weakly coupled degrees of freedom, and this is just a statement that the number of these weakly coupled degrees of freedom changes with energy scale.
Right.
So that's.
But the somewhat unusual thing is still that there is. Strictly speaking, the short distance structure. The short distance limit is singular. But still, luckily, there is at least no absolute overall divergence. And I think we understand physically what it is. It's just as you hit it harder and harder, you see more and more colors. And.
But you wouldn't expect deconfinement eventually? When you heat the system?
Yes, yeah, this is the deconfinement. this is the deconfinement phase. So in the UV, you really see the individual colors, right? But in the infrared, everything is of order one, right? And you just see the discrete spectrum of blue balls. So this is the calculation done in the limit where X is much smaller than this blue ball mass scale. So just to emphasize, this lambda here, which is the scale of all global masses, will be of order 1 over G string M times R star. So this R star that you see in the logarithm, right, 1 over R star, you have to divide by G string M to get the scale of the global masses. Okay? And this is obvious from writing out the equation.
Igor, do you know what a black hole means in this background?
Well, this is, I hope to talk about it.
Because there's some, won't just have a 1 over R fall off, presumably. There could be logarithms.
It's a complicated story.
I mean, it sounds like a
Alex has started working on it, and now we're continuing.
Okay.
But I think the story that we seem to be converging on is that there actually is a regular black hole Schwarzschild horizon in this geometry. So there is a solution which at really large R is just this cascading tail log R over R to the 4, and then you come in and there is a horizon, mm-hmm. and this describes the chiral symmetry restoration. It describes the phase where chiral symmetry is restored.
What about, I'm still confused about the deconfinement. Before you said there is no horizon, and therefore there is confinement. Now you tell me
there's always confinement.
He's talking about the UV.
It's a short distance. This is really how QCD behaves also, right? QCD behaves like this.
But there should be a deconfinement phase transition, not just an effective...
Yes, yeah.
It's a function of temperature. Yes. So
I'm writing a paper about this, but it's not famous.
He's shown us the finite temperature calculation too.
I haven't discussed a non-extremal geometry. That's very...
But that would show you really the...
That's a fascinating subject. It's really very complicated. Okay. This is just the calculation of correlators in the extremal zero temperature theory. I can still see, just like in QCD, I can see the free quarks from the short distance expansion of, right, from the asymptotic freedom. Except here, the theory is not really asymptotically free, but it's still the short distance limit is showing me free quarks.
But still independent of chiral symmetry breaking, just the deconfinement you would expect to be related to a formation of an horizon.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes.
Maybe this is a trivial remark, but am I supposed to think of this equation that you wrote with the effective and effective like you would think of an effective C function? I mean, in two dimensions, you would have the two-point function of the stress tensor.
Mm-hmm.
You would have had a C function times something, which is the... the anomalous dimension. There is no anomalous dimension for
yes,
the stress
yes,
tensor.
Yes.
But you have an effective C function.
Right.
So that's how...
That's how I think about it. I mean...
You have a proof.
I don't have a proof of it because... The reason I think it's extremely likely is because this is really the dilaton, which is a modulus in the story. And it would be very surprising to me if that by itself.
Have you looked at other operators?
Not yet. I think there will be more complicated twisted operators, which do have anomalous dimension. And
this operator is not a chiral, correct?
Those are definitely vital, though, because when you have to change the dose, when you have to perform an SL2R transmission of the whole solution.
Well, I think it just rescales G string M. I think that's the argument why it's a minimally coupled scalar. That.
Well, but if you have the Dilton equation in motion, it's box phi equals G squared, and G squared is zero upon the self-duality. But if you start sliding phi finitely, then G will no longer be self-dual, unless you also act on the G.
You have to do some bit of risking.
But so. That's a little complicated.
Okay, so this is, I think, an interesting thing to understand better. I mean, in principle, one should be able to.
How would you think of, let's say, this is a gauge theorem? Could you imagine formulating this on the?
In terms of a local Lagrangian.
A lattice.
On a lattice.
Well, why do you think it's a gauge theory?
You're saying you wouldn't describe it as a gauge.
It doesn't sound like a gauge theory, does it?
Well, what is
it? It's not asymptotically free, so what do you mean by it?
Well, it's just a gauge theory with two coupling.
You can have this formulation with some double scaling limit of taking n to infinity to take the last scale to zero.
That's how you think about it.
You can just think of it as a phase of some SU infinity theory.
Yeah, well, it makes sense.
No, but you have a more precise way. I mean, this is seems to suggest a well-defined way of combining it.
I mean, keeping an effective fixed, right, or something. Yeah.
Taking n to going like log of the cutoff.
Yes. Keeping this fixed. And okay, but the amusing thing is that this exponential falloff that. The exponential falloff that enters the so this is the part of the story that tells you that it's a confining theory, right? That when you move x as far away from each other, there is no n squared, there is one, and there is e to the minus m naught times x, and this m naught happens to be exactly the same parameter that you see in the log here. So I think that's what definitely we would call dimensional transmutation, even though the theory is not asymptotically free. Okay, so now I get to the bulk of my talk, which is well, I want to.
Well, but
how much
your theory is holographic, so you gave us the boundary. Now the bulk of it.
Well, now I just wanted to talk about some attempts to generalize it to other dimensionalities. How much time do you think?
Well, you've been an hour. So how much time do you think?
Maybe another 10-15 minutes at most. Yeah. Okay. But I would have to go a little faster. So these are these solutions of the same type that Arkady and I found, but for brains of other dimensionalities. Okay. So the idea now should be very simple and straightforward. Instead of taking a six-dimensional cone, you just take some 9 minus p-dimensional cone, put n dp brains and m wrapped dp plus 2 brains over this some internal cycle in this cone. Okay, so you're interested in cones which have this base, which is an Einstein space. This base has to have some 2 cycle. You wrap brains around the cycle. So the idea is to construct geometries which are dual to this, in the same sense that I talked about earlier, right? And this would be the symmetric phase, the chiral symmetry and broken phase, because I'm not yet deforming the cone. So what has turned out to be very simple is that the same ansatz that worked for the basic regular three brain works for the new story. Okay, so you put, remember that the string metric still had this symmetric form with the transverse part and the longitudinal part. E to the 4 phi is related to the same warp factor, and f also has a simple form. And the effect of the fractional brain is summarized in this extra flux, which is f6 minus p, which is the star. So the flux has to be proportional to the form dual to this omega 2, okay? So omega 2, you pick some harmonic 2 form on x. This is what the brain is wrapped around, Okay, and F, therefore, its field strength will be just the dual of this form. And B2 will be proportional to this omega 2. So these are just the generalizations of this Carnifold solution to other dimensions. And as before, we find that H of R is not a harmonic function anymore because of the effect of this Q. So if Q is zero, it's a harmonic function, and now this has an extra source. So it's very simple to solve this, right? And you find basically two terms. One is the solution of the homogeneous equation, which corresponds to the regular brains. And the other part is proportional to Q squared. So again, these are new examples of these varying flux solutions, because if this term is not there, then the flux doesn't vary, right? It's just a constant flux. And here, this creates the variation of the flux. So let me write down more explicitly what this is, just to give you a completely concrete idea. So for p equals 0, 1, and 2, p equals 3 is the case that Arkady and I obtained, and it has this logarithm. It's like a marginal case. For p equals 0, 1, and 2, this power is more singular at short distances than this. And this means that all of these also have naked singularities. So this falls off faster at large R, but at small r it creates this vanishing of H. So all of these are nakedly singular solutions, while for p equal 4, somehow this changed sign and became a plus, and there is no naked singularity. And then p equal 5 is a bit of a pathological case because it's wrapped D7 brains. So I will not discuss it too much, but here there seems to be a naked singularity at large R rather than smaller. And what we noticed is that this is completely in agreement with the most naive field theory dimension dependence you would expect. You basically, you know, you expect that in dimensions less than or equal to 3, there is strong infrared dynamics. In dimensions above 3, there is no strong infrared dynamics, but there is some UV stuff going on. And indeed, this extra term is, for p equal 4, indeed, in the UV, it's more important than this term. So it's kind of nice. And once again, I think this gives some new window on the strong infrared dynamics of gauge theories, because what we learned is that as we try to cope with these naked singularities, we actually find out what's going on, how symmetry gets broken. And we expect something similar to happen here, based on this deformed Carnifold example. And so let me show you an example, a very recent story, which is partly based on this, but mostly the work of Cvetic, Gibbons, Liu, and Pope. That is like basically a 2 plus 1 dimensional realization of this story. So here they found a concrete example. So we have two brains and wrapped D4 brains, okay? So we need a 7-dimensional transverse space to this whole arrangement. And this has to be, so you start with a cone. So you need to know some nice example of a 6-dimensional base of this cone that preserves some supersymmetry. And these guys are experts on this stuff. So they found, they basically, in some old work, they found a bunch of Einstein manifolds. And one of them is the S2 bundle over S4, which can be written explicitly as follows. So these mu coordinates basically specify the S2, then there is an S4, and then there is the instanton gauge field, which just describes the SU2 instanton and S4. And the whole thing, amazingly enough, turns out to be not only an Einstein metric, but also it has a Killing spinner on it. Okay. So it's one of these magical relations between gauge fields and geometry.
Doesn't have,
I mean, this...
it's not a coherent constant, because then when FC1 equals 0, it's not physically. What's the equation for the constant?
Well, it's the usual, I mean... Well, on the full 7-dimensional geometry, it's the regular Killing spinner. And on the Einstein space, there's this extra source term. Okay, so the remarkable, so what you would expect is that, remember that these wrapped D4 brains have some magnetic four-form flux that, by analogy with the previous case, would want it's piercing this S4, okay? And therefore, the naked singularity is presumably due to the fact that the S4 is shrinking to zero, even though there is a conserved flux through it. So this suggests that you should smooth out the cone in such a way that the S4 is kept finite everywhere. And amazingly enough, there is a seven-dimensional G2 holonomy Ricci flat space, which is asymptotically this cone, but at short distances does something analogous to what we had. Basically, S2 shrinks and S4 maintains a finite size. Okay. And then, so this is sir, yes. I think you will end up with, after you've inserted brains, you'll have just n equal 1 supersymmetry in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So the from the point of view of the gauge theory, this will be n equal 1 gauge theory.
And this count is 4 dimensional
counting? No.
Minimal.
It's the minimal, minimal supersymmetry. Okay, so then, as I said, the hard work here goes into actually the determination of these harmonic forms, because the equation for the warp factor is basically that the seven-dimensional Laplacian is minus the square of this harmonic form G3. And the G3 will just be the H and S and S, and its dual will be the magnetic part of the four form. So the solution of this is a little bit uglier than it was in the case of the deformed conifold, but it's still possible. I mean, there are some special functions floating around. But what they did succeed in showing is that, as expected, H just stabilizes at this tip of the cone, at the apex, at some constant. And at large R, it has exactly the right behavior that we generically determined with Chris Herzog, namely that there has to be this subleading correction minus Q over R to the C. So this smoothing of the cone precisely does the job of getting a fully resolved solution. And when you think about it, it's a totally different resolution from, say, what you might hope to get by going to M theory. Say, if you start with a stack of maximally supersymmetric D2 brains, then we know that E to the phi is just going to blow up, and then you have to go to M theory and argue for resolution this way. This is much simpler in a sense. It's purely string theoretic effect. What happens is that e to the phi grows for a while and then it just stabilizes. And
you can interpolate between the two possibilities, right? If you take e to the phi to be big, then it would look more like the M-theory case.
Right.
Can you add constant to H?
Well, if you add the constant to H, it just means that you're not in the pure ADS limit or ADS type limit, right? Because then you're adding this asymptotically flat region.
Fine.
I mean, what I think Juan has really emphasized to us was that you really want to remove this constant so that...
No, but if you add constant to H, you do flow to asymptotically flat region.
Yes, yeah. H, you can always shift H by an overall constant. Then you adjust this constant. Because H really satisfies the first order equation.
So there is a solution really which has a deformed conifold at which does go to asymptotically flat.
Yeah. Because remember, I was solving equation H prime equals to something.
Yes.
So that integration constant is this freedom to either exclude the flat region or to add it back in. And the same happens here. So once again, if I go to the sort of large Toft coupling limit, I blow up the whole geometry, then everything is resolved. And what is a lot less clear for this example is what is the dual field theory picture, I think. And that I'm thinking about with Matt Strassler and other people. But it's there somehow, when we were working out this conifold example, it was fairly clear what was going on both sides. Here we're much less clear about the field theory.
A lot more n equals 1 theories in three dimensions, right?
But here you do have some special global symmetries, and so this should give a clue I think.
Yes. Why would you expect to have more supersymmetry broken in this case than in the other one? I mean, in the other one, you're getting n equals 1 in 4 dimensions, and in this one, you're getting 1 half.
No, just step. Because it's a G2 holonomy space, right? It's just the way it's built, it has only one Kelvin spinner, I think. Yeah, that one was a Calabi-Yau space, right? So.
You can probably also find other spaces which have the same cycle, which preserves.
Yeah, that, now this is the game, basically. The game is find spaces which are symptotically cones, which have these two cycles and have some killing spinners. And I'm sure this is not the last word on the subject, but I was just very amused by this work, because I think...
Has anybody done something similar to this for ES7?
For ES7, it's very, very hard, I think, because the whole notion of fractional brain, right? Because you already... Well, that's what Chris and I looked for. I mean, that was sort of our original motivation. What you would call fractional M2 brain, that would be ADS4. So you would need to wrap an M5 brain over a 3-cycle, but it seems very, very hard to find such spaces.
In this case, the flux is constant in the UV, right? Or not?
I think the D2 brain flux again vanishes in the UV.
Okay. And doesn't just the usual 1 over to the 5th term dominate, and don't you go over to the constant flux?
Oh, sorry. You're saying in the UV. Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you were asking. Yeah, in the UV, so it's not an infinite cascade as you would expect. So this is in some sense maybe less pathological. Yeah, because
it looks like it would be just a standard field theory.
Right, it's a standard field theory. But yeah, that's part of the appeal of these systems in less than 3 dimensions, that in the UV they have weak dynamics and the cascade. So if it's a cascade or something like a cascade,
this will still be a non-trivial conformal field theory in the UV, right?
Well, it's not conformal at all, right?
It's like the D2 brain.
Oh, I'm
it's
sorry.
It's like the D2 brain. Yeah. But it's
it might be a free field theory in the UV, which is what you would hope for.
It's very interesting, I think, and to be able to say more. And then, so let me just, sorry to overload you with information, but. For example, you would expect that there are a lot of similar things you can do for one brains, because then this transverse space is 8-dimensional and there are a lot of these spaces known. And so here's just to give you a flavor for what one can do is to take, so you will have some 7-dimensional manifold, which is an Einstein space. This was, of course, studied at great length by the 11-dimensional supergravity community. And one of these spaces is this Q111, which is really like a generalization of T11 to 2 more dimensions. It has this structure. It has SU2 cubed cross U1 global symmetry. It's really very similar to T11. You basically have 3 2 spheres and an S1 bundled over them. So it has lots of global symmetry. And then what we want to do is basically stick in N D1 brains and M rep D3 brains. And this space does indeed have 2 cycles as required, and it preserves supersymmetry. It will preserve N equal 2 from the 1 plus 1 dimensional point of view. So our guess for what the field theory is, in principle, this is not a perfectly scientific question. You can just find out what is the theory on D1 brains at such singularity. It's certainly an answerable question without... we didn't approach it systematically. We basically guessed the answer, which is... it's pretty clear what it should be. You'll have 3 gauge groups, and there will be... In T11 case, we had 2 of these doublets, which realized SU2 cross SU2. Now we have 3 doublets, and they will be by fundamentals arranged in this way. And this was also inspired by work of the Tarina group, Frey and collaborators, who were trying to figure out what happens in M theory compactified in Q111 when you have ADS4 cross Q111. So this solution again exhibits this varying RR flux. Again, it's not a it's not an infinite cascade, but it's a finite cascade, which as Offer suggested is perhaps best thought of as just Higgsing, where you break. So presumably after you've gone all the way to the infrared, you'll just be left with the UM, and N will dissolve to zero as it did in the other cases. Then there are also, so these are these wrapped brain solutions. Then
in this case, you don't expect the infrared dynamics to be similar to the previous case.
No, no. So it's yet some other infrared dynamics. And then there are also solutions which don't in an obvious way correspond to wrapped brain wrapped brains, but are more like deformations by relevant operators. So suppose you have a space which doesn't have this two cycle to wrap around, but you can still turn on some extra forms and just see what happens. So it's sort of in the spirit of Polchinski-Strassler, except in some of these cases you don't need inflated brains to resolve the singularity. It's just, again, this stabilization of the warp factor and supergravity that does it. So it's a bit like just adding mass terms. So the simplest examples I know of are in M theory. And so there are various Ricci flat spaces, eight-dimensional Ricci flat spaces. One of them is the so-called Stenzel manifold, which is the like a conifold but with one extra complex coordinate. So it's defined by this. It's a smoothed out cone over this Stiefel space V52, which is a coset space. And what, so Cvetic et al. Constructed a smooth solution, which they first called a fractional brain solution. But in fact, when you look at it, there was nothing fractional brainy about it, because this space has no three cycles. So you can't think of it as due to wrapped M5 brains. In fact, but it's still a fascinating solution, because when you actually trace what it is you're doing, I think you're just adding some mass terms in the field theory, which is ADS4 cross, dual to ADS4 cross X7. So it's a flow where you start at the conformal point, you add the relevant perturbation, you flow, and instead of reaching a singularity, the cone smooths itself out, the warp factor stabilizes, and you get something like a confining phase. So that's would be really fascinating if we could do something like this, not in M theory, but just in string theory and D3 brains. But I haven't learned to do that yet. Or it might be impossible, actually. I have a feeling that it's not something. Well, I mean, something like that. Well, of course, what Joe and Matt did sort of starts with the same setup in the UV, but then they needed to bring in extra stringy ingredients on top of supergravity. But then in these cases, which are sort of analogous, they just live in a slightly different dimensionality, you don't need the brains, you just...
In ADS4 cross S7, when you cross
X7,
when you turn on the perturbation, you do get expanded brains. So,
right. So maybe if you're it's not. That's what's confusing to me. That there are cases when it's possible.
How much mass you turn on? I mean, if you turn on 3/4 of the masses, then you get expanded brain. Otherwise, the fields are not strong enough to polarize your brain.
Oh. But doesn't it depend on the original degree of supersymmetry and the topology of the space? Because here, the space, even before you started adding perturbations, just the basic setup was already much less supersymmetric than ADS4 cross S7. So maybe that's what's responsible for it. So let me just finish up. So just as a summary, it seems like there is a variety of new supergravity solutions and also some other possible solutions one can look for with more fancy Ricci flat spaces and more fancy resolutions, and I think they really do teach us something new about field theory issues. There are already some rough checks, and I think there is much that remains to be done.
Further questions? Yeah, actually, Igor. can, going back to the theory you were discussing at the beginning, you showed us the thing that ends up with n equals 1, pure n equals 1 gauge theory, but there was a choice there. Presumably you can get QCD with some number of flavors.
Yes, flavors is in, we certainly can cascade in such a way that you're left with a bunch of just regular D3 brains.
So do you know what how the Goldstone bosons associated with the real chiral symmetries show up in that description, in the supergravity description?
We think of them as just still this warped, deformed background, and then some actual brains. Sitting there.
So yeah. you just think of
we it just literally add actual brains.
I see. So you don't describe the Goldstone boson part of it in terms of supergravity.
Right. Because
it in terms of that doesn't surprise me, but I'm sure.
Because if there are just a few of these remaining brains, I think they're best added as explicit sources. Or there might be some other ways of adding flavors, which might be better than this.
Okay, well, let's thank Igor again.